people in Hollywood who produce shows like this and who make shows like this and write shows like this, they do want that authentic element. And that's what the company that we all work for, well, we pride ourselves on, that authenticity.
How does it go from that idea and then down on paper to the next steps?
It was one of those moments, again, where you kind of look around and go, boy, I love what I do for a living. This is more fun than anything I can imagine.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor. Jim, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Francie. It's so great having a new year and you're so far away. It's so cool. Well, Jim, New Year's wonderful. I'm just talking about the...
Your New Year's resolution was a lot more kindness toward my co-host, Francie.
That's the ticket. Yeah. Well, Francie,
we do have listeners who occasionally say, Francie, does Jim actually like you, or is it just something you pretend?
Francie, everybody knows I love you. Oh, did I say that? Francie,
obviously,
we have a guest. Shouldn't we be talking about that?
We should.
Okay. Yes, don't ignore me.
We have a very special guest today who is...
Hi, my name's Grant Anderson, and I'm a producer and a creative executive in Hollywood. I work with Jim Clemente and Francie Hakes at XG Productions and mostly work in scripted television, which is a very exciting area of television. And in particular, I happen to specialize in crime genre programming. I've worked for CBS, which was one of the... is arguably one of the best crime destinations for TV viewers. I've been the current executive on the entire CSI franchise, NCIS, NCIS Los Angeles, Criminal Minds, where I work with Mr. Jim Clemente. Yes, and so I've spent a lot of time in the crime world in television.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah, I'm really sorry. I know that we work with Grant and we love Grant. And I consider Grant to be a close personal friend. But Grant, I have a bone to pick with you right off the top.
Okay, then.
CSI. It was the bane of my existence as a prosecutor. I cursed you. I cursed that show. And I still do because it convinced jurors in random town United States that there's always forensic evidence. By the way, there's not.
So it was arguably the most useful tool for me to get out of jury duty over the years, because they would literally come to juror number 5 and say, tell us about what you do. And I'd say, oh, I'm a producer and a creative executive. And they're just like, oh, what do you do? Is anything we know? CSI. Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Yeah,
and they'd show me the door.
We're lucky you didn't get arrested. But anyway, we can talk about that another time, Jim.
Right. But the thing about that is that what it did was it made everybody believe that not only is there always forensic evidence, but that there's always a digital high-speed video in incredibly good clarity of the crime being committed and all of the different forensic aspects. And it's going to be presented to you by beautiful Hollywood people with bright blue eyes and flowing hair and wonderful, wonderful, amazing $5,000 outfits and $17,000 shoes every time.
You know, the shoes thing is actually a funny thing. You know, on CSI Miami, one of the running jokes was whenever a body was found on the beach, Emily Proctor, who played one of the leads, and some of our other leads would wear spike heels, and the grips would spend hours laying board underneath the sand and then covering it so they could walk across the sand in their heels.
No way.
And, you know, arson scenes, Mark Helgenberger on CSI is wearing all white and she wouldn't get a smudge on her, man. It was a different kind of crime show.
Well, you know? I have to say the sand trick made me feel that made me feel inadequate as a woman, that I couldn't walk in the sand in spiked heels, but it makes me feel a little better And now I know there was a trick.
Talk about bringing our listeners behind police lines.
There you go. I mean, but one thing CSI did do is it did make scientists and the folks that aren't, you know, sort of the gun-wielding cops heroes. It actually took, you know, much like Criminal Minds cool did nerds. With the thinkers. Yeah, right. Cool nerds became a cool thing. So I think it served a purpose, and it certainly made CBS and Anthony Zeiger a ton of money. And Jerry Bruckheimer, who didn't need it, but he got it. So there you go.
Wow. Well, Grant, we are here to talk about some particular event or events in your life that you feel you want to talk about. Where in your career were you when this particular set of events occurred?
I had just come out of a 6-year run working for CBS as a current programming executive. And that's a person at the studio who essentially oversees creative and production aspects for a television show.
Terrible show like Criminal Minds, maybe?
That's right, Criminal Minds. I had been covering, again, like as I said, Criminal Minds, both NCIS and NCIS LA, all three CSIs, and had done some pilots and things over the years. And Shane Brennan, who was the creator of NCIS Los Angeles, was forming a production company and asked me to come over and run that company and kind of build it from the ground up. So that's sort of where I was when this particular best case I would consider, which could have been a worst case if it went wrong, but it was a really exciting kind of moment in a pilot that I executive produced.
Jim, I think that's what they call a teaser in the TV business.
Really?
That's right. That's the setup. Wow. That's the cold open to this whole thing.
Okay, cool. Well, and tell us what happened. What were you doing on the day that this whole thing began?
I was in my office, and I was at this point in my career, I was, in addition to sort of helping run some television shows, and I was working on NCIS LA as now the production company executive for that show. We were also developing television. We were coming up with new ideas and new things to take to our studio, which was CBS Studios. And I was in my office, as I always was, like making a lot of phone calls and chasing people down and thinking about new ideas when Shane Brennan, who is the creator of NCIS LA, walked into my office.
Where exactly was your office? Was it on the lot?
Yes, my office was at Paramount Studios, which is the only real film and television studio left in proper Hollywood. You know, it's been around 100 years. It's been owned by a bunch of different. Yeah, it's one of the only ones really left that's actually physically in Hollywood. Sunset Gower is another one that's still around. Paramount, had gone through a lot of owners. Gulf Western owned them for a while. At one time, it was actually split between the Paramount Studios and Desilu Studios, which was another half of that studio. And eventually Desilu was sold to Paramount and they knocked the walls down. Interestingly enough, my office was on what used to be the Desilu side. In fact, NCIS LA's offices were and still are over in the Ball building, the Lucille Ball building.
And so that's obviously Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, right?
That's right. Yeah. In fact, right outside of my office door was a little fountain with koi pond in it. And in that, the fish in that koi pond, they'd been put in there by Lucille Ball back when it was Desilu as a place for her kids to hang out and kind of watch the fish and feed the fish. And all these years later, you know, so many years after Desilu went away, people were still feeding those fish. And that was a pond that was taken care of by the Paramount Studios gardening team. And so that was right outside my office. I was up on the second floor. And oddly enough, my office at one time had been Gene Roddenberry's office. So as a Star Trek fan, that was an awesome thing to be in that room, kind of absorbing that energy of that space. So,
okay, so there you are.
I'm in there. And Shane Brennan comes in. Shane Brennan is the creator of NCIS Los Angeles. And just prior to this, CBS had given us the go-ahead on a show called King and Maxwell, which was a series based on the work of a guy named David Baldacci, who I'm sure a lot of your audience know. He's on more than number one. Yeah, I mean, David is just an unbelievable novel writing machine. He writes like 3 a year. And King and Maxwell was the story of two Secret Service agents who are now investigators. And we'd been approached by David's team about turning this into a TV series. And Shane, being the incredible sort of writer he is of crime fiction and also comedy, because we wanted it to be light and fun. Shane was in the process at that point of writing the script because CBS Studios had said, let's go to script on this thing. And we had at that point sold the script and the idea to TNT as a series for their network. And so Shane was in the process of getting this pilot put together, and he walks into my office and he says, "Hey, I've got an idea about how to open this." Because, you know, you want to open a television show. You want to tease the audience, as Jim just said earlier, with something kind of spectacular and fun that sort of sets the tone for what you're about to do for them for the next 42 minutes and change, right? So he had this idea. He said, "Hey, how about we open this with a huge car chase? Only it's not a car, it's a bus. It's a tour bus, a big, huge tour bus. And it's being driven by this guy who's kind of crazy. He's a criminal and he's in a beaver costume. And we're going to have this massive high-speed chase through the streets of Washington, D.C. And it's going to culminate with this bus rolling and flipping and the beaver guy getting out and running on foot. And our Michelle Maxwell character, who would eventually be played by Rebecca Romijn, is going to chase him down. And it'll be kind of a fun chase sequence." And I said, "That is a really exciting idea. I have no idea if we can afford to make that once we know what our budget is, but why don't you write it? Let's swing for the fences and let's see if we can actually pull this thing off."
Okay, wait a second. Wait, I'm sorry. Beaver costume? Where does he get a beaver costume? What does that have to do with Washington, D.C.? I'm really confused.
I honestly don't pretend to understand the minds of writers like Shane Brennan, but for whatever reason, the beaver costume was central to this chase scene. And by the way, you have never seen a foot chase, which happens after the bus roll, like a guy in a beaver costume. It's one of the funniest things.
I watch the show because I love the show. But Grant, this brings to mind a question for me. And that is, okay, so you've got Shane Brennan. He's going to write this show about former Secret Service agents turned investigators based on a David Baldacci book. And like, how is it going to be authentic? I don't know about you, Jim, but I never had a case where someone I prosecuted was in a beaver costume. Now, I've prosecuted some pretty crazy cases where people were wearing some pretty outlandish things, but I'm pretty sure none of them were in a beaver costume. So where does he get the authenticity, or where do you, as the guy who's going to run the show, where do you get the authenticity for something like a crime show?
Well, it's interesting because, like, in this particular case, the beaver costume chase and the bus chase was not an element of the book that David had written. We actually based the start of the series on the fifth book in the King and Maxwell series, which was, in fact, entitled King and Maxwell. And that particular opening chase sequence is not a part of the original book. It was something that Shane had added, because when you take something, and Jim knows about this quite a bit, when you take something from a book and you adapt something, there are certain things you have to do for film and television to sometimes get through the story faster. We literally compressed a 500 and some odd page David Baldacci book into a 42-minute pilot. And then that concept served as the basis for the series. But as far as authenticity goes, you know, they weren't active Secret Service agents in this particular story. They're now private investigators who are retired. So what we did was we kind of come up with a balancing act there. As private investigators, we can do anything we want with them because, you know, we're going to obviously, you know, we're going to have interesting technical advisors. You guys have been technical advisors on television shows who will come in and make sure we're sort of following the law about what a private investigator can do. The PI thing gives us a little bit more room to have fun, obviously. So we're not locked into them. They're not going to cuff anybody. They have actually no real legal authority. So we can be flexible there. However, there were elements of the series where we did have to fall back into their Secret Service time. And whenever that happened, then authenticity became extremely important. Then you had to really make sure, okay, if these are ex-Secret Service agents, and if we're going to show something from their past that has them, you know, being Secret Service agents, we're going to make sure that's right on point. I don't recall at this moment who the person was who was advising us on Secret Service, but I know they were, as Jim would be with profilers and you would be with anyone who's in the law, Francie, very pointed about making sure we were correct in the things we did.
That's an interesting thing that certainly I found as I've broken into the Hollywood career and getting into producing, is that people in Hollywood who produce shows like this and who make shows like this and write shows like this, they do want that authentic element. And that's what the company that we all work for is, well, we pride ourselves on that authenticity. But, you know, you do see things that seem somewhat unrealistic. But I think it's important for our listeners to know that we do strive to have that authenticity there by asking people who've done these things to tell us about them, and then maybe adapt what they've done a little bit for Hollywood, but try to hew fairly closely to it.
But Grant, so you have Shane, who's come up with the beaver bus roll chase scene. And you know, that's an idea. And who knows how much that costs, because it's never been done before. But no. How does it go from that idea and then down on paper to the next steps?
Well, at this point, what we were also doing was we were essentially building the team to make this pilot. We had not been at this point greenlit to series yet. So, you know, very often in television, unless you're at a place called like Netflix or one of these other sort of streamers who like to pay for everything up front, very often you'll do what's called a pilot episode, which is kind of the proof of the concept. You'll shoot an entire episode of the show that's essentially going to be the first episode of the eventual series in order to prove to the studio and the network that it works. And then they're going to put it through testing with test audiences, and you're going to tweak it and you're going to do these things to it. And this is the process we were in at this point. We had been approved to shoot a pilot. And what we knew at that time was we were probably going to shoot the pilot in Toronto because we needed to get to Canada, because you can make things a little less expensively up there, but you get the same great quality, you know, and especially in Toronto and Vancouver, which are huge. I mean, they are literally Hollywood North, both those towns. Toronto, a little bit more of the, at least it used to be, a little bit more of the film side, and Vancouver, a little bit more of the TV side, but now it's a real blend. We knew we were going to Vancouver, so we knew that our budget would be, or excuse me, Toronto, we knew that the budget would be a little bit smaller. So yeah, the first sort of alarm bell, and of course Shane knows this, he's done hundreds of hours of television. We didn't know if we could afford to do this scene. We, for all we knew, that 55-foot tour bus that was going to roll could turn into a 1988 Ford Taurus by the time we were done, depending on what we could afford. You just don't know. But you know, when you do a pilot and you do a series, you try to make it, you know, especially when you're first selling the show, you try to make it makeable because you want them to say yes to you. But when you're sort of going through that process of really building up towards actually shooting something, you take big swings on certain things because, you know, in a budget for television and film, you'll often rob Peter to pay Paul. You'll take some money when you're a little, say you didn't have a ton of money going into set deck for that particular episode. You might be able to take some of that money and stick it into a stunt like a, you know, like the beaver bus roll that we were going to do. So we were in that process at this point, and we were hiring. Okay.
Found the title for the episode.
Beaver bus roll.
Yes. It was a big, believe me, it became a massive point of conversation throughout the whole process, because it was quite literally the biggest element, single element of what we were going to do. And it would only take up about 4 minutes of the actual show. But at this point, we were also hiring some of the key people that were going to be involved in making the show. And that included our director, Michael Cattleman, who, if you look him up on imdb.com, you will see he has directed a lot of really great stuff over the years. Michael's always got big appetite too. He likes to do big stuff. So we knew he would love the idea. We had just hired Don Tardino, who was the longtime producer for CSI Miami. That's where I knew Don from. And he's an absolutely amazing line producer. This is the person who's going to be essentially in charge of the physical money and sort of scheduling the production and really getting it moving, a lot of the sort of internal elements. We had also just hired a director of photography and a couple of other people. So at this point, we were kind of in that stage where we were moving forward towards production. We were probably 2 or 3 months out at this point from actually making the show. And one of the things we realized at this stage that we were going to need to pull this off was a great stunt coordinator. And Michael Cattleman had worked in the past with one of the most famous legendary stuntmen and coordinators in all of Hollywood, who has the most stunt coordinator stuntman name you've ever heard, Buddy Joe Hooker. And, and again, if you go onto imdb.com and you type in Buddy Joe Hooker, he has a resume that's as long as every arm on an octopus. This guy, I'm not joking. This is a guy who basically has, you know, credits like Hooper. He did all the car chases for To Live and Die in L.A., Sharky's Machine, The Right Stuff. I mean, you could literally go on for 15 minutes on Buddy Joe's credits. And one of his specialties in particular, aside from High Falls, was beaver bus rolls. Well, complex vehicle stuff was something that Buddy was just is known for. He's a legend. And so we hired Buddy Joe to coordinate all the stunts in the pilot. And there were a couple, mostly physical sort of fight stuff, but we did have a pretty substantial car chase to start the episode off with. And we figured Buddy could pull this off for us on the pilot. So I can kind of roll forward past a little bit of the nuts and bolts of getting ready to shoot a pilot, which is essentially 8 to 9 weeks of utter terror as you're hiring people and looking for locations and bringing things, especially when you're shooting in Canada, bringing in actors and working in visas and all kinds of other things that were going on. So If you cut to about 8 weeks later, we are now in Toronto. We're probably about a week out from shooting the pilot, and we have Buddy Joe up in Toronto. We have Michael. Everybody's there now. We've got all of our people. We've cast everybody. And we're now sort of in the prep stages for not only the pilot, but there was an entirely separate prep going on for nothing more than the Beaver bus roll sequence, because it was going to be such an enormous endeavor, especially for a television show. For a feature film, this might not be a big deal. It'd just be one of many stunt scenes they were going to do. But for a TV show, there was a lot of, you know, a lot of blood and treasure going into this particular 4-minute sequence.
Jim, this reminds me actually of trying a case. I mean, think about it. Putting together a complex case is like putting together a TV pilot. It's exactly the same. There's all kinds of preparation that goes in with the investigation, building the case, making sure you've got all the evidence, bringing in all of your witnesses. I mean, it's really no different than putting together
and
a show.
In your case, Francie, all the lights and cameras and hair and makeup and the shoes.
The stilettos, the nails. Come on. It's all the same. I mean, let's be honest. Giving a closing argument is no different than being an actress. I'm well aware of that. Anyway, but granted, it occurs to me that those are actually very relatable things, because what you have to do to get together to shoot a pilot is exactly what prosecutors have to do to put together a case to put in front of a jury. They're the audience.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. You're thinking many, many steps down the line at this point. And you know, one of the biggest jobs as a producer is always, you know, I've always described it this way. If the production is a giant steam locomotive hurtling down the track at 85 miles per hour, and your director is standing there turning knobs, and you know, you've got your crew there throwing all kinds of coal into the boiler, into the firebox, and your DP is up there controlling the speed, guys like me have our head out the window making sure there's not a cow on the track, you know, and that you grab the mail as you go by. You're trying to sort of, because everyone is so dedicated to doing their specific jobs as a producer, you're sort of, you've got the luxury, frankly, of kind of a 30,000 foot view that you can then swoop down into that 1,000 foot view on with your department heads. And if you hire the best people, you get the best work. And that's something we always do. We make sure we've got the best department heads, the best people, and people you trust and you know can deliver for you. And we had definitely done that on this pilot.
So there you are. You're in Vancouver, and Buddy Joe, who's got to be a Southerner,
Buddy Joe
is there with you, ready to do this.
Actually, I think Buddy Joe's from Northern California, if I remember correctly. I think he's from Northern California, but right. So am I. So automatically, I dig Buddy Joe. So we had gotten to the point now where we had acquired this bus, which we were going to roll at some point. So it, you know, it wasn't exactly a brand new Prevost right off the line. This was an old Greyhound that had, you know, seen a few days, but it was, you know, it had a working motor. And so what we had to do at this point was prep this bus to get ready to do this thing. You can't just roll a bus with somebody in it. There's a lot of work that goes into doing that type of a stunt. And so Buddy Joe was working with structural engineers and other stunt coordinators to essentially at this point turn the bus into a vehicle we could do this stunt with, which involves putting a roll cage in it, reinforcing things, putting these things called soapers on the rear wheel so that at 70 miles an hour, he could slide the bus sideways into a controlled slide, and these explosive pills, which are these massive metal posts, if you will, that would be secured inside the bus so that Buddy could hit a button when he slid it to the right moment and literally fire these pills into the concrete and flip the bus over, help it roll over on its side.
It occurs to me, when you're discussing all this preparation, you didn't tell us how the network executives who are buying this pilot from you reacted to the idea of the Beaver bus roll. I mean, this seems completely outlandish.
Well, it's an interesting question, because it brings up the contrast between the studio executives and the network executives, because the network executives are like, heck yeah, man, we love that. This is going to be fantastic. The studio executives are going, we love that. Can you afford it? That's the first thing they're asking you is, can we actually afford to do it? And the truth is, with a guy like Don Tardino, our line producer on board, Don figured out a way for us to be able to afford to do this. But the real challenge, again, in television is we were going to get one shot at this. Once we roll this bus, that was it. That bus was done, and we didn't have the money to do it again. So in the prep, everything had to be thought about, every little aspect. And you do that anyway with stunts because, you know, people are potentially in jeopardy. It wasn't just Buddy Joe who was going to be driving the bus that we had to think about. It was all the other stunt people and crew, frankly, who were going to be nearby filming this thing. You know, there were stunt drivers that Buddy Joe had to weave in and out of. We literally had to do this choreography, this dance of probably 20 cars plus the bus. So Buddy could go at 70 miles per hour and weave in and out of traffic in this very well coordinated stunt. So we had finally gotten the bus to the point where it was drivable and it had the soapers and all the things that Buddy needed. But the question became, you know, how can we slide this thing? And I remember we were actually in the parking lot of our production facility in Toronto, and Buddy rolled up in the bus. He wanted everybody to see it, and they had not painted it and set dressed it yet. But we were curious about the sliding thing. And of course, you know, stuntmen and stunt coordinators are some of the most meticulous people in town. They have to be, because lives are on the line. They really have to be accurate. But they're also guys who are, you know, famously the type
of... a little crazy.
They're a little nuts. And if you say to them, hey, how's that work? They're going to show you. And we had said, gee, how's that going to look when it slides? And next thing we know, Buddy Joe's rolling the bus at us, activating those soapers and sliding a 55-foot tour bus sideways in a parking lot with absolute precision, like an ice skater in the Olympics. It was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. And it was proof that this was going to work in theory. And again, you can practice all you want until you get to the day. If you've practiced enough, you hope it's going to go well and it's going to go the way you've rehearsed it. But there we were, sort of ready to go. And we kind of knew, okay, this is now going to work. We know it's going to work. Now, we, of course, had not fired those explosive pills yet. That part is one of those things where on the day we're going to throw those things and the bus is going to roll. And at that point, as Buddy Joe famously said, you're just a passenger. You're not in control of the stunt anymore at that point. You know how far it's likely going to slide. Again, these guys have done this a lot of times.
Let me ask you a question, Grant. What do you think makes stuntmen willing to put themselves on the line like this for entertainment? I mean, it's very different from someone like Jim or his brother Tim or all the law enforcement guys that we have on this podcast all the time, putting their lives on the line to protect the public. You know, it's a really noble calling. But here you have a stuntman who's going to roll a bus, a stunt which is surely potentially death defying, and he's doing it, you know, for a television show.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Yeah, it's interesting. People who go into stunts are a rare breed. They're very different than a lot of other people. Some people fall into it. Some people are just, you know, they might be ex-acrobats, or they might be a lot of military people sometimes will get involved because they know how to fall. Athletes get involved in stunts. Sometimes it's a question of you're such a kind of a general looking person, you can double for anybody. That's less of a factor these days because you can replace people's faces digitally in 5 minutes. But, you know, it's also a familial business. If you look at some of the, there's some famous stunt families like the Baxleys. I worked with Gary Baxley, who did most of the Dukes of Hazzard stunts back in the day. There's lots of Baxleys in stunts. And Buddy Joe's wife was actually going to be driving one of the cars in our stunt sequence. So, you know, you'll find that very often in stunts, people sort of, it becomes a legacy thing for a lot of times. People grow up around stunts and they just sort of naturally gravitate towards that side of the business. But they are very often highly technical people, and they're also people who are adrenaline junkies. And you'll find that certain people specialize. There are some people who, you know, like the late Dar Robinson, who did the famous fall in Sharky's machine. Dar Robinson was known for high falls. That's just what he did, and he did it really, really well. There are other guys who are known for being firebugs. They're really good at fire stunts. They get work on things, you know, again, not as much work anymore because very often now fire is done digitally. But in the old days, there were people who were just really good at fire, and they would be fine with being lit on fire. And they had practiced it a lot and gotten burned a lot. They were good at it. You've got guys like Diamond Farnsworth, who's been the longtime stunt coordinator and stunt double for Mark Harmon on NCIS. You know, Diamond's been around forever. And for what, and again, another great stunt name, Diamond Farnsworth. It's just perfect. Either that or he invented radio. It's like perfect. But he's known for actually being able to have great, he's like really good fight scenes. That's really good. He's also really good at getting hit by a car. For whatever reason, Diamond, it's funny. In all the stunt guys I've ever known, when you talk to them and you ask them, how do you learn how to get hit by a car? They all say the same thing, which is you do it slowly first and then you do it at full speed and you learn how to fall. And very often the process of learning how to fall involves some injury that happens off camera. I've never met a stunt person in my life that doesn't have some scars and broken bones and hobbles a little bit. But they've got a calling. They love to do it. And I think they all get a bit of a thrill. And there is also something, and this is what I'll get to in a minute about the best case scenario that we have here. There is something truly wonderful about pulling off a great stunt, especially a practical stunt. You know, in an era of a lot of digital stunt work where, you know, actors defy gravity and stuff like that, and you can tell there was no real stunt, there is something still quite attractive about practical stunt work. Like the last great car chase movie I think ever made that didn't use any digital was Ronin, you know, John Frankenheimer's Ronin, which was, you know, some of the best practical car stunt work ever done on camera. And again, that's something that Frankenheimer was known for. He had done, you know, some incredible movies like, French Connection 2 and stuff like that, that had great car work. It's an interesting thing. People just find their way into that side of the business, and some of them stick there, or then they become Burt Reynolds, who started as a stunt guy and became a big actor. Yeah. You know, so you never know.
Okay, so there you are. You're as planned out as you can possibly be. You're as ready as you think you can be.
Yes,
Buddy Joe is ready to climb into the.
Oh, and by the way, he had not had his costume fitting yet for the beaver costume. And that was another process too, because he needed to be able to drive this bus while wearing a full, when I say beaver costume, I don't mean some like tight fitting thing. I mean, full blown furry Disneyland-esque with giant head mascot type of thing.
And he's got to drive and crash and roll a bus in that. Mm-hmm.
In that with the full headpiece on. So there were, you know, practical elements of even making his suit fit just right, making sure his hands were free enough underneath the fake giant paws, and making sure he had enough field of view through the beaver headset to be able to see where he was going so he didn't crash into the other stunt people in this massive multi-ton bus, right? So
Grant, fun fact, you might not know this about me, but my very first job.
You have a beaver outfit?
No, almost.
I want to know about your real private personal life, Francie.
When I was 16, my first job was at Showbiz Pizza.
I worked at Showbiz Pizza. That was literally my second job. I made pizza for Showbiz Pizza.
My very first job, I was a dining room attendant. I had to wear a little vest and a bow tie and a top hat. Very humiliating. But worst of all was climbing into the Billy Bob the Bear costume, which I routinely had to do because of the kids' birthday parties.
Yes.
And I had to dance around in the bear costume. And I can tell you this.
Francie, I finally realized what your calling in life is. It's obviously running around at little kids' birthday parties in a bear costume. You've definitely missed your calling since then.
It's not, because inside those costumes, it was as hot as the surface of the sun.
It's like a swamp.
You can't see a thing. So I can only imagine that the beaver costume for Buddy Joe had to be better than the Billy Bob the Bear costume that I used to have to wear.
It explains so much, though, Francie. Billy Bob the Bear. Okay.
It had only been worn by Buddy Joe. See, that was my problem because I had to wear, you know, Showbiz was co-owned by Chuck E. Cheese, as you might recall. And at our particular branch, we had a Chuck E. Cheese costume. And for whatever reason, there was this one guy in the kitchen named Edgar who liked to wear the Chuck E. Cheese costume. So it was great because none of us had to ever climb into the Edgar costume. But here's the thing. One time Edgar wasn't at work and I was low man on the totem pole and the manager came and said, hey, there's a birthday. Somebody's got to get into the Chucky costume. And here's the problem, though. As you'll probably recall, Francie, I think Francie's about, what, 5'4", Francie? 5'5", something like that? I'm 6'3", and, you know, 200 plus pounds, and that costume is not made for that. So I had to squeeze into every inch of that costume, which Edgar liked to occupy on a regular basis, and Edgar sweated a lot. And so that was kind of rough. I had to go home after that. I wasn't quite right for a couple of days.
No, Billy Bob the Bear was
Beaver bus roll.
So let's go back to Buddy Joe and the Beaver bus roll.
Yes. So let's now cut forward about 5 or 6 days. We've now started shooting the pilot. And when you shoot a pilot or a TV show, very often, you know, you shoot obviously out of sequence quite often because you're often driven by location availability and actor availability and things like that. So as I recall, and this is, you know, going back a few years, we had scheduled this particular sequence for a weekend. And it was about a week into the shooting schedule, which was about a 15-day schedule. And the reason we scheduled it on the weekend was because we were going to shut down roughly 8 to 9 blocks of what's called Queen Street in Toronto, which is one of the longest, sort of busiest drags in that area. And we were going to do it on a weekend. And as you can probably imagine, we were not popular in Toronto that weekend because we had essentially closed down cross traffic in one of the busiest areas of the city. The normally nice, sublime, very polite Canadians were not happy that this Hollywood crew had come in and shut down everything on Queen Street.
They were muttering under your breath. It's not like, I mean, Canadians, let's face it, are just nice.
Yes, open hostility from Canadians is quite benign by comparison to Los Angeles. But clearly, they weren't quite happy with us to do this. But we needed those 2 days because we had to set the stunt up because we could only practice so much. We had to literally then move in all the cars, get all the stunt drivers there, and do a lot of rehearsing on that street of the 70-mile-per-hour chase that goes for 8 or 9 blocks.
So it really was done at 70 miles an hour?
It was fast, and I know it was fast, and I'll tell you why, because the day before when we were doing one of the test runs, and this was a little bit slower speed, we wanted to get a sense of what it would look like because we had mounted cameras in there, and of course the camera crew was going to be in there wearing helmets and things like that for one part. And we had to shoot multiple parts before we rolled the bus. The very last thing we could do was roll the bus. So it involved days of filming sequences inside, over the shoulder of the Beaver guy driving the bus, and outside shots, and you know, we were doing this over the course of this 2 days, and the
days of shooting for 4 minutes on television.
It may not even have been 4 minutes. I think it might have even been less. I think the entire chase scene might have been 4 minutes. I think the bus part of it might have been 2. But we had shot multiple angles, every single angle we could think of to get before we destroyed this bus. And so here we are now on Sunday. Oh, but by the way, the quick story is the day we were doing the first couple of run-throughs where Buddy Joe was figuring out his timing, at one point, the director and a couple other people had gotten in the bus with him and they were going to do a quote unquote slow speed run just so that they could sort of set the look inside the bus. And I was standing out there and Buddy Joe said, hey, you want to join us for the test run? I said, sure. I got in. It was one of the most terrifying 45 seconds of my life. And I've raced race cars, but there's something about being in a big tippy bus going very fast with Buddy Joe Hooker at the wheel. Although again, it's Buddy Joe. So you trust him 100% because he's a genius.
If he just decides to hit that button? While the
button is not armed. In fact, I even leaned over to Buddy Joe and I said, keep your finger off the trigger, Buddy Joe, because, you know, I don't want to have any surprises. But anyway, so we were at the point now, and this is getting to the best case part of the situation, where we were going to actually shoot the bus roll. We'd done all the shooting we could possibly do. We now had 3 or 4 active crewed cameras at various stages of this run. We had probably 20 GoPros and various types of stunt cameras mounted to different parts of the bus so we could catch every angle of this. Because remember, we could only do this one time. And if we messed it up, it was either calling the studio to ask for several million more dollars or it was going to just be, you know, a wash and we would go back to that Ford Taurus. And we had brought things like what's called, something called a Russian arm. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of that, but a Russian arm is this very high-tech remote crane and camera that is attached to a Porsche Cayenne turbo, because we needed a car that could go fast enough in these sequences to film every angle of this in a really dynamic way. So we
could drive in that car, Grant.
I would have loved to drive that car. That was quite a car, and that's quite a thing too. That's a whole nother conversation about what it's like to be inside of a Russian arm car, because the camera people are all in full gear and helmets, and it's quite amazing. So anyway, we're at the point now where we're going to shoot the bus sequence, and I'm standing with Michael Cattleman and Shane Brennan and Don Tardino and the rest of the crew at essentially the top of Queen Street, which is an area that's up near sort of like this park. And 8-9 blocks away, there's our bus. All the cars are staged. Literally half of Toronto is watching from the wings. There are people that had gone into there was an opera going that day, and they were in this opera house, this performance house, and people were looking out the windows. And we're getting ready to shoot this sequence. And Buddy is down there in the full beaver costume. He's got the full head on now, and he's sitting there idling this bus. And you know, the assistant directors are talking. We're making sure all the, you know, areas are secure, that no one can come into the middle of the street. And it was one of those odd moments where we're clearly ready to shoot, but we were all just kind of standing there ready, but no one had said go. And I remember
how much money's on the line right then, Grant.
A lot of money and time. And again, we're about to do something dangerous. Buddy Joe's going to be in that bus. You know, we're going to roll this thing. So there's a human being involved in this too.
Yes.
And so we're standing around, and I remember it very distinctly, because I remember Michael Cattleman, and we've all done this for years, so we've been around a lot of stunts, but here we are. So we are now several months down from the moment when Shane Brennan walked in the room and says, I think I want to roll a bus with a beaver guy in it, to actually getting ready to roll the bus with the beaver guy in it. It's literally going to happen. And I remember Cattleman looked at me and kind of grinned, and he said, I think we're ready. And Tardino says, I think so too. And Shane goes, let's go. And I said, all right, let's go. And then Michael Cattleman said, roll camera. And the next thing you know, it was action. And here comes Buddy Joe. And he's flying now. Now, see, this is when you get to that point where we're past rehearsal now. And
he's going a little too fast, maybe?
No, see, that's the thing. That's what you don't do. Younger stunt people might over kind of crank on that, but not a guy like Buddy Joe. But it doesn't matter, because Buddy Joe is in this massive bus now. We've said go. He's flying up, weaving in between cars, and he's getting closer and closer and closer to us. And we know the spot, because it's Buddy Joe's decision about when to blow those explosive pills, when to slide the bus. He's getting closer and closer. And I remember it was one of those moments where time kind of slowed down for a moment.
Yeah,
and
sure.
I looked around, and again, these are people like Don and Shane and me and Michael and the crew that was so experienced. We've done these things before. But I looked around, and everyone had the same exact expression on their face, which was one that was sort of a mix of awe and anticipation and pure joy that we were getting paid to do this. Like, it was shocking to us. We're getting paid a bunch of money to stand here and do something little kids talk about all the time. How far can you jump that thing?
I have to tell you, when I was a little kid, I had never in my wildest dreams thought about growing up to do a beaver bus roll. Just have to tell you that. I have to put that on the record.
I don't know, Jim. I think you did. I'm just going to put that on the record.
Figuratively speaking, just the notion, though, of here we were actually doing this, you know, and we're all these jaded Hollywood people. And yet in that moment, we were all just completely transfixed with the fun and the real privilege of what we were getting to do. We were getting to do something so outrageous. And here it was. It was finally happening. And so here comes Buddy Joe. And at that moment where he hit his mark, all the cameras are rolling. He hits that soper. He throws that bus sideways. And then this bang, which we had not heard up to that point, happens. And those pills shoot out of the bottom and flip that bus like a pancake. That thing went over at 50 or 60 miles per hour, whatever he was doing. And that thing ground to a halt, right? And there were pieces flying everywhere. There were GoPros flipping off that thing like catapults. It was insane. And it finally grinds to a halt. It's dead quiet. Safety runs in there. We're all kind of waiting. And Buddy Joe pops out of the top in his beaver suit, and only had the complaint that he didn't get the bus sideways enough. He didn't think it was quite sideways enough, but it was a brilliant stunt. I mean, it was absolutely brilliant. And we pulled it off. It actually works. And there was this bus in the middle of Queen Street smoking and on its side, but we had done it. We had taken Shane Brennan's vision of a beaver bus roll and made it real.
So I just have to ask, though, when the bus rolled, I mean, when the thing blew up and the bus is sliding and it flips over and slams on its side and skids to halt, I mean, he had to be shaken up like crazy.
I honestly think with a guy like Buddy Joe, you could crack Buddy Joe in the head with a Louisville Slugger and he'd probably laugh it off. Buddy Joe is a level of tough that's hard to quantify, you know, and you got to remember at this time too, I think Buddy Joe is right now in his 70s. So at the time, Buddy Joe was coming up on 70 when he did this stunt for us, but you wouldn't know it because, you know, Buddy Joe can bench press like 300 pounds. He's this really compact, really robust guy who can run, you know, miles in the morning. He's like the picture of health. And so, no, he popped out of there like nothing, man. If it hurt him. Nobody got hurt. Nothing went wrong. Although we did discover as we were, you know, collecting all the debris and stuff like that, that we were actually missing four of our little tiny remote cameras. And so much like, you know, in a real crime scene, the entire crew got together holding hands and we walked down Queen Street for several blocks looking for our missing footage. And we found one in a planter that was like literally 100 feet away. It had flipped off and flung across the whole block. We found one in a gutter and somebody had to retrieve it out of there. We found one under one of our other.
Sounds like crime scene work. This is CSI. Wrong.
It really was. We were like prairie dog and heads on swivels trying to find these. And we found all of them, which was remarkable. We figured some Toronto native was going to go away with a nice souvenir of our stunt sequence, but we did find all of them. And, you know, a couple months later, when that show aired, when we got picked up the series, that was how we opened our show. And people loved it, man. They loved that sequence. And again, it was such an odd stunt sequence. It wasn't traditional. It wasn't tropey in any way, shape, or form. It was something no one had ever seen, especially on TV before. It was fairly high, you know, high quality, and it was large. And we had a blast making it. And it was one of those moments, again, where you kind of look around and go, boy, I love what I do for a living. This is more fun than anything I can imagine.
We weren't getting that from you. And the way you were talking about it, we just didn't get that enthusiasm.
I feel like in one of our future shows, we've got to pay homage to King and Maxwell and get a beaver bus roll in there somehow.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go. We can roll another bus.
Serial killer can dress like a beaver and flee the scene in a bus.
I'm sure Buddy Joe would be at the ready.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. So, Grant, we have to ask you, because this is best case, worst case. Do you consider this a best case or a worst case?
Oh, this was unquestionably a best case. This was everything going exactly right and everything sort of being exactly what you hoped it would be. It was an absolute best case.
Well, then the last question has to be, how much did it cost to do the beaver bus roll?
Do you know, I honestly don't remember. It's been so long and so many budgets since then. I do know that it was a substantial portion of that pilot budget to get that done. Like I said, a lot of blood and treasure for that little 2.5-3 minute sequence.
Well, I'm definitely going to go online and see if I can find a clip of the beaver bus roll to post on our Facebook page for our listeners.
I remember when we did Washington Field, I think we had a $6.2 million budget for that pilot. Are you saying that like you spent like $3 million to do that? Is that
possible? Not at all. In fact, our budget, I can't get into the details. That's proprietary, but our budget was a lot less than that. Right. Again, because we were shooting up in Canada. Right. So we were making that thing. And again, you wouldn't know. That's the real sort of dance you do with any budget is you put as much on camera as you can and you try not to spend on things that are frivolous. And we found a way to do that on that pilot and on that series. We were able to really get a lot for the money we had to work with. And that comes from experience too. And again, having the right people around you who aren't, you know, wasting money on stupid things and knowing you're going to get it right the first time. You know, we didn't have second takes on the Buddy Joe bus roll. So.
Wow. Yeah, really.
Yeah.
That's amazing. What a crazy story. I would like to see Francie though in that, what was the bear costume again, Francie?
Billy Bob the bear. Billy Bob, by the way, had a band. And so there was this whole big animatronic stage show at Showbiz Pizza. It was Billy Bob and the Rockafire Explosion.
I wish our listeners could actually see Francie doing her little hand wave back and forth in the Billy Bob the Bear costume.
Never going to happen, Jim. Never.
Oh, and by the way, let's not forget, when you're in that kind of a costume, kids misinterpret you as being a pinata. So you get battered around, and that's a stunt job right there. You get battered in that costume.
Well, for me, there was a lot of hugs and a lot of birthday cake smears on the Billy Bob costume.
Mm. Pretty gross. That's really gross.
And on that note, everyone, it's our crack producer, Josh Murphy, chiming in. Go ahead, Josh.
Grant, I know that when you listed out your resume there at the beginning, man, you got a lot of heavy duty crime shows. It's a lot of murder and serial murder and a lot of crazy stuff. Could you explain what it's like to do that day after day and how much you relish the opportunity to do crazy fun shit when you do get the opportunity to do something like roll a bus with a beaver driver?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I have to say, in that 6 years when I was covering that big CBS crime wheel, you know, that was sometimes anywhere from 100 to 120 episodes of television across those shows per season. And, you know, a lot of it, especially like Criminal Minds and things like that, was pretty dark stuff. And and I think it did weigh on me after a while. Honestly, there were times where I would get pretty exhausted about all the horror of it all. And a big part of that job too, when you've got so many crime shows going simultaneously, is that, you know, producers will see things that happen in the real world and go, that's a very interesting, maybe jumping off point for an idea. And so very often, or they'll just come up with an idea and there'll be something in the ether where all of a sudden Criminal Minds is calling you on the same day that CSI Miami is calling you, that the same day that NCIS is calling you, and they're all trying to do essentially the same story. So you're suddenly having to separate the crime kids from each other to make sure they're not stepping on each other's story. But yeah, I mean, after a while, you know, I think I did over 600, 700 hours of programming, 800 hours of it, something during that time. Yeah, it adds up. You kind of you're looking for something that's a good laugh, which frankly was why things like NCIS and NCIS LA and occasionally Miami were shows where you could kind of get a break from it, because they do have comedy elements in it, and it does give you a little bit of a breath of fresh air with a joke here or there. King and Maxwell was far less dark than some of the other things I'd done. But I think it's all interesting. Look, and as long as the story is good, as long as the characters are compelling, and as long as there's something really interesting to take away from an episode, you kind of find your way around the horror part of it. You know what I mean? And if the audience can do it, I can do it. So there you go.
Great question, Josh. Jim, that was Josh's first question ever, I think.
Well, you mean on the podcast? I think I've heard him ask questions before.
I don't think so. Incessant questions behind the scenes. Maybe it's because I mute him all the time. But
yeah, maybe it's because you're so caught up in everything you're asking. I have to say, Francie, though, today you must have had a very compelling New Year's resolution to not interrupt our speakers, because generally, if I may be so bold, you do that all the time.
I know, but I did it a bunch, Jim. I think you were sleeping in this episode because I interrupted Grant constantly.
Not as much as you usually do.
I was so smooth about it.
Is that what it was? You're just getting slicker in your new year. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's good, because I tend to, as you all know, be a little garrulous at times. I will talk quite a bit, so that's good that I'm stopped on occasion, so I don't just keep rambling incessantly and boring your listeners.
Oh, actually, you're great. You have so much enthusiasm. And I will just say that when I, you know, this whole beaver bus roll reminded me of when I was in law school. You ask why, Francie, right? Why? How is that possible? But I'm sure you, when we were covering complete diversity, one of the things, when I went to law school at night, I worked at a law firm full time during the day and then basically ran to law school and then, you know, did my 3 or 4 hours there a night and then went home and studied and went to bed for a few hours and then did it all over again. But when I was coming home, I noticed that there was this little tiny, it was literally the size of a doorway in between two buildings, where there was a guy set up and he would make these, you know, sort of tourist headlines. So you could, you know, say, you know, if your name was Billy Bob, you could say Billy Bob visits New York or whatever on this headline, this New York Times headline or Post headline. So I decided one day when we were covering complete diversity in Civ Pro, to get a headline made. And then I would, when I got to class, I passed it up. And, you know, I passed it up to different people in front of me and it got to the teacher. And it said, 50 bathing beauties battered in Bayonne bus bash-up. And, you know, and then it said after that, complete diversity, question mark. So he saw that, my professor saw that, and he just busted out laughing. But it just reminded me of that wonderful time when I was in first year law school trying to learn 75 different things, and complete diversity was one of them. It's the fact that, you know, it's complete diversity when all the different participants in a lawsuit are from different states. So you can remove it to federal court. So,
and we have the bus in common with Grant's story. So
there you go. So it just reminded me, the Bayonne bus bash up reminded me of the Beaver bus roll. That's
all. We all have a bus story. We all have a bus story. Yeah.
Or a bear costume story if you're Francie.
There you go. Well, true.
And on that note, Grant, thank you so much for coming on Best Case, Worst Case to talk to us about this best case of yours that's crime related. Jim and I talked about it ahead of time and with Josh, of course, and thought that maybe starting the year off with something a little lighter than our normal, you know, murder and mayhem might be advisable in this crazy world we live in.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you for having me on. It's been a blast.
Well, we've enjoyed it very much. Thank you, Grant. And now get back to work. No, let's go make some great TV and let's figure out how we're going to top the Beaver bus roll, because
there you go.
That I would love to do. And maybe we'll have a show coming out soon on, I don't know, something related to CBS. And we could maybe do something like that in that show.
Sounds like a plan.
All right, great. Well, thank you for coming on to Best Case, Worst Case. Until next time, signing off.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production produced by Francie Hakes, Josh Murphy, and Jim Clementi at Empire Studios LA. Engineered and edited by Matt Gergel. Music composed and performed by Simba Sumba and hosted by Wonder.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness Delight can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's d2l.org.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.